for their courtesy and grace in adjusting the schedule this morning. Counsel for the appellant, are you ready to go?
Morning, Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of the court, Captain Jeff Davis, and along with Captain Michael Schramma, we represent Captain Nettles. I suppose this might be a bit unorthodox, but this case seems to me to be both factually and legally complex and interesting.
Can you hear in the back? You're getting nods. You're okay. Sorry. Thank you.
I'm certainly prepared to carry on with an argument I've prepared, but my primary interest would be to address the issues and concerns that the court has regarding this case. I'm happy to get interrupted right on the front end to make sure that I spend my time talking about what the court thinks is most relevant with this case.
What do you think is your best argument?
I think a statutory argument, Your Honor. I would start with Captain Nettles' discharge was made mandatory by a federal statute. That discharge could only be delayed by the Secretary of the Air Force.
Aren't there two orders? Didn't the military judge find that there were two sort of competing contexts? One is that there was an order from the convening authority, the Lieutenant General bringing the Nettles back indefinitely on active duty, insert correct words there. And on the other hand, you had the operation of law that you're arguing for here. So you don't have just a blank, you don't have just the IRR order, you also have this order. And so what do you do then?
I would disagree a little bit with that characterization of it, Your Honor. So I would be looking at Joint Appendix page 40. This is the 12 June of 2012 order by the convening authority regarding Captain Nettles. And I don't believe that that order recalls him to active duty. What that order did was made him available to be recalled by his unit as they see fit. So the order says that the duration of active duty is indefinite, but the member may be released from active duty and involuntarily recalled to active duty as necessary. And so,
but you didn't complete it. It says until the termination of disciplinary proceedings.
Yes, okay, I apologize. Yes, Your Honor, I do agree with that. So what I see happening with Captain Nettles during this period is he is being bounced back and forth between periods of time on active duty and then periods of time where he's just back in the IRR like he always was, subject to recall. And it just so happens in this case, the discharge order that was published on the 25th of September and then took effect on 1 October, he was not on orders during that time. He was just back in the IRR being subject to recall. Well, if you're discharged from the IRR, you're not subject to recall anymore. So this case...
Does that mean, I take it by implication, then the military judge, when the military judge said or found in paragraph, on page 4, as of 1 October 2012, there was in existing... two conflicting valid orders in regards to the accused.
There were two orders. I just don't think they're conflicting. Because the order from, if Captain Nettles had in fact been recalled, the government, of course, looking at the blank documents here, was doing this on the cheap. If they recalled Captain Nettles to permanent continue active duty, now they have him give him a paycheck every day. They don't want to do that because they want to save money. So instead, they just recall him as needed for all of his hearings. If the government had chose to recall him indefinitely the whole entire time, then I think you might have a different case, because then on 1 October, when the order hits, he's not in the IRR. Now, I think there are still arguments to be made in his favor.
What difference does that make? He's either a member of the Air Force or he's not.
I agree, Your Honor.
You got a discharge, or you got an order purporting to discharge him from all appointments in the Air Force.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If he's on active duty, he's discharged.
I agree with that, Your Honor.
If he's in the IRR, he's discharged.
I agree.
End of story.
I agree, Your Honor.
So what difference does bouncing back and forth make, especially since the reg seems to contemplate that? I don't even know what it stated. Was he in the NARS or was he in the IRR? The record seems to be unclear. And NARS, of course, is a standby status. It's not a ready status. So what Do you know what he was?
I do not, Your Honor. The record is unclear.
He's bouncing back and forth between active duty and some non-active duty status. But it doesn't really matter, does it? If you've got an order discharging him from all appointments, it discharges him.
I would agree, because once 1 October hits, he's no longer available to be recalled. So even if this order from the court-martial convening authority says indefinite, it's not indefinite to the extent of a federal statute. Because a federal statute discharging him by order of the President of the United States is going to override, you know, an order by the General Court-Martial Convening Authority. He's no longer in that status. The jurisdictional question is a question of status. What's his status on 1 October? On 1 October, his status is he was released from all appointments. He's no longer available to be appointed to be put on active duty. And then what that would kind of lead into is an argument I really didn't make as clear as I would like in the brief, is the revocation of the order. So,
which order?
The revocation of the order that discharged him that became effective on 1 October. So the government lets approximately 5 to 6 weeks go by with that order floating around, and then I think the date is 8 or 9 October, they revoke it and essentially purport to put him back on active duty. Now, in the brief, I talked about the AFI and how that affected it and whether the government had the authority to do that. But there's a more basic question outside of AFI for the publications of orders is, who had the legal authority to revoke that order? Was it the senior master sergeant who signed the order, or the 06 colonel who signed off on the bottom? I think not. That order was issued by the President of the United States. The only federal statute in place is the one the government cited in their supplemental citation of authority, which says that the Secretary of the Air Force may delay the discharge. So I don't think that some secretary that works in the admin office has the authority to revoke that order. And at this point, when the secretary didn't choose to delay it, I don't even think the Secretary of the Air Force had the authority to revoke that order. They would have had to go on straight to the President of the United States.
It's really a secretarial order, isn't it? The statute says he shall be discharged upon being twice passed over.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that really a secretarial action?
I mean, given that the statute delegates, given that the statute says the secretary may delay it, I think I would concur with you on
right.
that.
Right, but your point is that it's not an E-9.
No, it is not. It's not an E-9. You just can't say, well, since government's asking us to undo it, we'll undo it. I don't think it works that way, because this is a very unique discharge that was mandated by a federal statute. This wasn't an ETS discharge that maybe, arguably, you could have undone looking at some other federal statute or some Air Force regulation. The deadline or the effective date of the discharge is also specified very specifically in the federal statute. And it says just a calculation, 8 months from the first Monday, and that's the date. And everything we have in the record says that date was 1 October. So I don't think, with all due respect to the court gets to mess around with that number and say, well, we're going to change it. The federal statute doesn't give anyone but the Secretary of the Air Force the authority to do that.
Okay, so going back to 1168.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which admittedly doesn't fit this situation that well, but it's a statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you answer the government's contention that manual delivery of the discharge certificate is a condition precedent to being discharged? And I understand that to be the government's contention.
Yes, Your Honor. So a number of arguments along those lines. I think the first basic one I made pretty clearly in a brief, my primary argument is we just don't never get to 10 U.S.C. 1168 in this case. The plain language of that statute says it applies to release from active duty.
It applies to discharge or release from active duty.
Yes, Your Honor.
He was released from active duty sometime before when he got out of the Guard. He's a reserve officer.
Yeah, I mean,
you know how it works with reserve officers. They're released from active duty, and then they go into some pot, which used to be a computer out in Denver and is now a computer in Georgia. And they're in the NARS for a while, and they're in the ISLRs for a while, and if they don't stick up their hand for anything, they're eventually discharged. So,
is that all in the record, that there's a computer in Denver and Georgia?
I'm not sure all of it is, Your Honor.
Right, why don't you stick with what's in the record and tell us what your argument is.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I'm not certain entirely I understand the question, but the first thing I would point out to is, with regards to a DD Form 214 discharge certificate, Captain Nettles did, in fact, receive one of those when he was discharged from active duty, and that's in the record at Joint Appendix 30. And my understanding of the record is that's at that time he was discharged from active duty. And
he was separated from
active duty.
Right. He went into some reserve status, did he not?
Yes, Your Honor. Right. I see that. But 10 U.S.C. 1168, I don't think Congress intended that to apply to members of the IRR.
How does a member of the IRR know when they're no longer in the IRR?
I think the IRR is relying on the mail system and the fact of the member being required to keep an updated address with them.
The mail system, but what do they get in the mail?
Well, we know they get three things. Well, in Captain Nettles' case, we know he was due to get three things. First, I believe the date was 12 March 2012, he gets a preliminary letter from the Air Force Reserve Personnel Center saying, sorry, Captain Nettles, you were not promoted. And in accordance with federal statute, you're going to be discharged. The effective date of your discharge will be 1 October, and you will receive a discharge order and a discharge certificate forthcoming. So he gets that first. And then according to the testimony from the clerk who works in that office who sent that letter, he was going to get the discharge order and a certificate in the mail at the same time because that's standard course of business for them. Now, in this case, they had the discharge order as of 25 September. It was effective 1 October. They did not have the cardstock to print this pretty little certificate. So they chose to hold the order instead of sending them separate. So he would have received all three of those things, and he probably would have received them very close in time to 1 October, but for there being no cardstock.
But he did not receive anything in the mail.
Other than the letter.
The original letter.
Yeah, and I apologize, I misspoke. I'm looking at it now, Joint Appendix 34. It's 14 March of 2012 when Captain Nettles received the second deferral for promotion.
He didn't receive the pretty little certificate until he received it from the government.
That's correct.
Here's your pretty little certificate, and we just revoked it.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And what I would come back to, I guess as a bottom line that I can't back up any further on the whole receipt issue, is if it's true that the government, under the circumstances of this case, didn't have the authority to revoke the order, or to, in this case where we've gotten now today, they can't, then his receipt is just the result of the government unlawfully not handing it to him. If you can't undo it, that is the order, the government has no choice but to just sit around until the government gets cardstock. The order's valid. It was
should the government be stopped from arguing non-receipt since its own action caused the non-receipt?
I think an interesting question is how long could the government have done this? It went on for about 6 weeks before they revoked it and tried to recall them. Could they
go six months? I'm more concerned with the government saying, you didn't get it, the fact that you didn't get it because we didn't have the right paper or we wanted to save a stamp, doesn't matter. You didn't get it, and that's all that matters.
I think it's a fair point. Unless the court, and no court has, and there's been no allegation of fraud on the part of Captain Nettles.
I'm not talking fraud. I'm just talking, you know.
Yeah, absent that.
The government had total control over the process, and the government screwed up.
Yeah, I agree, Your Honor, and I think it's a fair argument. And in some level, it goes back to some language from this court from the Harmon decision, and the court in Harmon was basically saying, look, we have some concern about this idea that a discharge clerk sitting in an office gets to decide when a discharge is effective or when it's not. That seems kind of arbitrary, and now the rule of law is that a discharge is effective when a clerk chooses to hand it out. Well, a ruling of that nature would be the same. In this case, we're saying it's arbitrary when Captain Nettles' discharge was effective because the clerk could have held it for 4 weeks, they could have held it for 4 months or 6 months. And I don't think that's how the law works. Captain Nettles just doesn't sit around bouncing in the ether not knowing what's going on. And it's like, well, as a result of bad luck or good luck, however you want to put it, his discharge is either effective or not effective. I mean, the question is, what does the law say? In this case, we have federal statutes that made it mandatory. The federal statutes also stated specifically when it was effective. We have an Air Force regulation that said it was effective at 2,400 hours on that date, 1 October, and the government saying, well, we never received it. Well, the federal statute doesn't require a receipt. and he didn't receive it because of actions by the government and no wrongdoing on his part. So I don't think a ruling of that nature is consistent with what the court was concerned with in Harmon. And I would go back to language from the Watson case, and it's a long quote, so I'm not going to read it all, but effectively what the court was saying in Watson towards the end, because the whole entire Watson opinion is all about what does this Army regulation mean and who had the authority to do what. And what the court says at the end of the day in Watson is, look, we've told you guys, the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, you guys can write your regulations how you want, but we're going to hold you to them. And in that case, the court interpreted the Army regulation the way they did. And one of the things the court said is, your regulations need to define when the discharge is effective or not. And that was one of the reasons the court held in Harmon the way they did. Because in Harmon, the Marine Corps had a regulation that said it's not effective until 2400 hours. Well, in this case, the Air Force does have a regulation, and it dovetails completely with the federal statute. At 2400 hours, the discharge for a reservist is effective. It doesn't say that receipt is required. When you combine the Air Force regulation with the federal statute, I don't see how you get around the fact that on 1 October, he was discharged.
So, taking a step back, going forward, the way this court should view it and the way that the various services should view this is, if someone is in the IRR and the civilian division head of the transition program division sends out a letter and says, 6 months from now, you're gone. The only way that that can be revoked is by the service secretary signing off on something revoking.
I don't know that I would go that far, Your Honor.
How far would you go?
Well, I would say you look at the federal statutes of which the person was discharged under, and you look at the service regulations. It's sort of that simple. Now, in this
so
case,
if it's that simple, then what's the answer to the question?
The answer to the question is, in any discharge for an IRR member, look at what federal statute they're being discharged under. If it's a twice deferral, this federal statute applies to all the branches. So I would say any discharge under this federal statute, twice deferred, goes to the same result it does in this case.
What statute was being applied when the convening authority recalled the person to active duty indefinitely? Was the convening authority acting outside the law?
No, I don't think they were acting outside the law by making him available to be subject to recall. There was nothing wrong with that. Here's what I'll concede. I don't know if this is helpful because I think the court knows I concede this, but it's essentially Vanderbush. The government could have taken actions in this case to have avoided this. The Secretary of the Air Force clearly has the authority to do that. I can't deny that. He has the authority to do it in every single case, or she. They just didn't do it here. And basically they're asking for a whoopsie. We didn't get it done, so please let us say since we tried. And I believe my time has expired.
Did you have your question answered? Any other questions, sir? Thank you, counsel. Yeah. Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Major Mary Ellen Payne, and together with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. The Air Force had personal jurisdiction over appellant at the time of his court-martial. Jurisdiction attached over appellant at the very latest on 8 May 2012 when charges were preferred, and that jurisdiction was never severed by a valid discharge. Appellant was never delivered a copy of a discharge certificate or its equivalent, and the reserve order created on 25 September 2012 by Ms. Darcy Blair was not validly generated and therefore could not act to discharge appellant. Prior case law from this court has made clear that delivery of a valid discharge certificate is necessary for a service.
Are you relying on King, or what are you relying on?
I'm relying on King, Your Honor. I'm also...
King applied to a IRR member, or is that an active duty member?
King specifically talks about active duty circumstances, but if we look at United States v. Watson, this court's case from 2011, This court applied the King factors in the case of a reservist officer in determining whether or not she had been discharged. So, and I think as Judge Stuckey was saying to appellant's counsel, if we look at 1168A, which certainly King is based on, I don't believe that that statute distinguishes between being discharged and
So in the government's view, is the key event the issuance of an order with an effective time of 2400 on a date certain, the delivery of a discharge order, or delivery of the Form 256? What is the critical act in the government's view?
We would say in this case it was the lack of any delivery of a discharge certificate.
What is a discharge certificate?
In this case, the discharge certificate would have been the form, the DD form 256.
So you want us, that would be a conclusion then that whether there is jurisdiction in the military depends on Staples and the supply of bond paper. That strikes me as an absurd result.
Well, Your Honor, I think that you have to, I think that you have to look at this court's prior case law and where this court has talked about the importance of actually receiving a discharge certificate.
In active duty context, but here the judge found there were approximately 1,000 people who did not receive their certificates because they're out of some sort of paper. And it's the government's view that unknown to them, all 1,000 people were still in the military.
Well, Your Honor,
that seems a very odd way to run a military, and I bet you there are a lot of reservists out there who'd be surprised, or former reservists who'd be surprised they were still reservists because they never received their 256.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that the rules for court-martial do put some sort of onus on the military service member, especially in the case of Nettles. If you look at the discussion to RCM 202A, the discussion says court-martial jurisdiction normally continues past time of scheduled separation unless a discharge certificate or its equivalent is delivered or until the government fails to act with a reasonable...
Well, didn't the government fail to act? The government generated an order, but the government didn't want to send the order without the discharge certificate, and it didn't have the paper. Why isn't the government stopped from arguing that? I mean, that's absurd. Is this like season? Do you have to put your hands between the hands of the Lord and receive the lump of dirt?
Well,
I'm serious.
Well, Your Honor, in...
Is it?
No, Your Honor, I think that...
Well, that seems to be what the government is contending.
Well, Your Honor, as I was mentioning, in RCM 202A, the government does say that this jurisdiction will continue... until the government fails to act within a reasonable time after a person objects to continued retention. And in this case, appellant, although he had...
Oh, you mean if he'd stuck up his hand on 2 October and said, where's my certificate? That would have divested the government from jurisdiction.
Not necessarily.
I don't know what you're arguing.
All 1,000 people had to call in and say, oh, gee, where's my discharge order?
Well, Your Honor, I would, and I can provide a supplemental citation in this case, but in this court in 1990 in United States v. Poole said jurisdiction to court martial a service member exists despite delay, even unreasonable delay by the government in discharging that person at the end of an enlistment, and that
counsel, we're not talking about the end of an enlistment, right? This is a little bit of a different situation. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
Would you agree that if the government, after referring charges, had just kept this person on active duty instead of bouncing them back and forth, then there'd be no argument that there wasn't jurisdiction if the government had done that, right?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know under those circumstances that we could have guaranteed that ARPC would not have still erroneously created that discharge certificate.
Do you disagree that you'd have a better argument if you had him in an active duty status for purposes of his court-martial from point in time A to point in time B?
I think that would be a better argument, yes, Your Honor.
Can you answer a question regarding 14505?
Yes, Your Honor.
And USCA 14505, that's the statute that talks about what happens to reserve to people that get passed over twice, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
What do you suppose the language that it starts with, unless retained as provided in section X and Y, that they shall be separated, what do you suppose that means?
I think, Your Honor, that there are certainly other mechanisms by which a member may be kept on active duty. I don't think that either 14-505 or 14-513 foreclose the possibility that a member may be kept on active duty.
But don't you think it's at least plausible to look at that statutory provision and understand it to mean that in the absence of affirmative action by the government, that the fact that they've been passed over twice means that they shall be separated?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I think if you look at 14-513, that's where you get the language that says unless the officer's separation is deferred or the officer is continued in an active status under another provision of law.
What did you do to defer him or to retain him in active status?
Well, Your Honor, those would be the actions by the General Court-Martial Convening Authority under Article 2D, recalling appellant to active duty.
And what date?
Well, the first time that appellant was called to active duty was for referral of charges,
right,
but then he was
released, right? So when the effective date of his discharge came around, what was his status?
Well, Your Honor, honestly, from looking at the record, I'm not sure we know exactly the date that he was released from active duty because there's no subsequent order release that's in the record, at least, releasing him from active duty.
There was orders bringing him to active duty for a period of time that was served, correct? Or incorrect?
My understanding, at least from looking at the June and subsequent orders, is that those particular orders said that appellant was being recalled indefinitely. But there was no specific date. Actually, I think that the date of the arraignment, which was 18 October, it said he would be called to active duty for one day. But as far as the June order, there's no termination date necessarily. And
well, so he was at home, right? He wasn't on active duty. He wasn't getting paid.
I think we could assume that, Your Honor, but we can't say for sure from what is actually in the record. But that would be a fair assumption, absolutely.
Yeah, counsel, isn't the reference in 14-505 to retention boards that can be ginned up under ROTMA?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's
okay, correct. Yeah, that's the reference. That's the cross-reference. Nothing was done here on that account, was it?
No, Your Honor.
He was a twice-passed-over guy.
Right.
And he's going to be discharged.
Right, exactly.
In fact, ARPC reported to discharge him.
ARPC, yes, they created a discharge.
Well, they issued an order effectuating the statute.
They did, Your Honor, but they ignored other documentation that had been sent to ARPC.
That's not the point. They did it.
Well, Your Honor, again, but I think if we look at the person who actually...
No, the government tried. I'm not denying that the government tried, but the government screwed up.
Well, Your Honor, I think this case has a lot of parallels, for example, to United States v. Garvin, which is cited in the government's brief. And in Garvin, we have a situation where discharge orders were revoked. And those discharge orders, although they were revoked, somehow that message did not get to the discharge clerk in that particular case.
But that's not this case. Any action purporting to revoke this discharge order didn't take place until a substantial period of time after 2400 on the day of discharge, right?
Well, that is true, Your Honor, but
okay,
I think
then it's not that case.
Well, I do, Your Honor. I would argue that there are analogies with this case because the government did take action that would attempt to stop his separation.
Right.
But
the government screwed up.
Counsel, there could be two ways to look at this, right? There could be way one, which Chief Judge Baker suggested, which is 1,000 reservists because something didn't get sent to them because the Air Force ran out of paper. Are retained somehow or not discharged, right? So that would be one way, which you could say is reasonable or not reasonable. Or we could look at what the statutes appear to provide, which is once they were supposed to be discharged, unless an affirmative action is taken by the Air Force to separate the reservist from active duty, their discharge, whether they get their piece of paper or not.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that there's any...
Which is more reasonable?
Well, Your Honor, I think if we look at this court's prior precedent, I don't think that there's any basis for saying that someone is just automatically...
Which of our prior precedent is involving a situation of a person in the appellant's position?
Well, I would concede, Your Honor, that none of the prior cases specifically address this set of facts. But I think if you draw on what the underlying law is and the underlying interpretation by this court, it can certainly be applied to this case. And certainly there doesn't seem to be any indication in this court's prior law that an individual can just automatically be discharged without receiving a discharge certificate. You're
not being automatically discharged. There's a message. There's a statute. I mean, it's not like they're automatically discharged by nothing.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would agree with that. I agree with what you're saying there, but I think in all these other cases that we've seen, there's still a necessity that the appellants or that the service member receives something, that they receive some sort of indication or notice that they're being discharged. Appellant didn't have that in this case. He showed up to his arraignment.
There's 1,000 people without their discharge certificate that are still inactive, still are subject to the military's control, in your view, because you ran out of paper.
Your Honor, I think if we look at the law as it is now, yes, I think that that's the conclusion that this court has to come to. And again, I would say in Poole, this court has said that, you know, sometimes even if the delay is unreasonable, that doesn't necessarily sever jurisdiction. And I think that that is what we have in this particular case. But, Your Honor,
the problem that you have is that reservists, right, if they're not actually in an active duty status, are civilians, right? I mean, that's the problem. That's the difference.
That is true, Your Honor. But I think what's important in this situation is that appellant did not believe that he was being discharged. He showed up to his own arraignment. Supposedly,
wait a minute. It turns on the subjective apprehension of the appellant?
I don't think in all cases, Your Honor, but I think we have to certainly look at it in this particular situation. Now, appellant had received back in 14 March notice that he was going to be discharged, but he was told that he would receive his separation orders and he would receive his discharge certificate when the action was taken. But he never received notice that it was actually taken, and certainly there were intervening steps that could have occurred in the interim, such as, for example, the Secretary of the Air Force the Secretary of the Air Force using his power under 10 U.S.C. 14518 to delay that particular separation. And, Your Honor, I think it's very noteworthy in this case that we do have a letter from a memorandum from the Secretary of the Air Force signed on the 18th of July, which is well before that 1 October 2012 date of discharge. We know what the Secretary's intentions were in this case. The Secretary's intentions were that appellant be held and be able to face sentencing, that he would be able to be sentenced to confinement should the disciplinary proceedings proceed that far. And I think that this court, in Harmon especially, and in a lot of other cases, has made clear that the subjective intent of the command or the discharge authority is important and must be considered in the whole scope of looking at this discharge certificate and this discharge and whether or not the discharge was actually valid. And here, Your Honor,
that's all very interesting, because now we're off on the subjective intent of the command, whereas before we have the talismanic invocation of delivery, which is it?
Well, Your Honor, I think I would say that the important distinction here is that delivery is necessary but not sufficient.
But if it had been delivered, but everything else is the same, what would be the case?
Well, Your Honor, the government's argument would still be that that discharge certificate was invalid, very much like
was void ab initio.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. Void ab initio.
Counsel, can I raise a little bit more of a philosophical point here?
Yes, sir.
In personam jurisdiction, the military is such a vital point, whether someone is subject to the military justice system. if there is even a whisper of a doubt about whether personal jurisdiction lies in a particular case, why should we not hold that against the government? Why shouldn't we make sure that you have dotted every I, crossed every T, that there is no doubt in the mind of this court that jurisdiction pertained in a particular case?
Well, Your Honor, I think if we're looking at what the government's burden in, at trial is, the government's burden at trial is a preponderance of the evidence. So I think this court, of course, reviews questions of jurisdiction de novo, but I think we're looking back and what does the government have to prove at trial? They have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. And so I think that this court, when it's looking on appeal, shouldn't be holding the government to a beyond a reasonable doubt standard as to whether or not jurisdiction exists. And I certainly think that the military judge was correct in his ruling when he found that by preponderance of the evidence that the government had demonstrated that jurisdiction existed.
So with de novo review, what standard should we be looking at?
I think still the question should be, is there a preponderance of the evidence that jurisdiction existed? Since that's the government's burden at trial as well. I do briefly want to touch on the issue of rescission. I think at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter whether or not the rescission was completed was valid, because I would argue that by the time the trial counsel discovered the separation order to defense counsel, he was not doing so with the intention that this act as a discharge certificate. And looking at the case law in this realm of jurisdiction, I do believe that consistently this court has said that the intention with which the delivery occurs is something that must be considered. But that being said, appellant's counsel said that continually referred to this as a revocation, but in fact it was not a revocation, it was a rescission.
It was a rescission because they couldn't revoke, right?
Right, under the AFI.
Under
the AFI's rescission.
Because you can't revoke an order already issued.
Right, Your Honor.
Which isn't that an admission by the government that the order is properly issued and at least is fair on its face?
Well, I don't think necessarily, Your Honor. I think if a discharge clerk is looking and following the AFI, they'll say, well, if this was already in, if this was allegedly already in, thing. I mean, I think it's...
Or for that matter, if the thing is void ab initio, why does the government have to do anything?
Well, I think that's certainly our argument at this particular stage, Your Honor, that, you know, it doesn't, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I mean, it just goes back to the fact that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter because it was void ab initio. But it just for the record, what happened was that it was actually a rescission rather than a revocation on the actual form. And certainly the discharge clerk in this case, according to the AFI, she did have the authority to rescind that particular order. And, Your Honor, I see that my time is almost up. If I may briefly conclude, if there are no further questions from the court.
Please.
In this case, jurisdiction over appellant attached over appellant at the referral of charges and was never severed by a valid discharge. Appellant never received discharge orders or a discharge certificate, and the discharge order generated in September 2012 was invalid because it was created contrary to other valid orders extending appellant on active duty. Therefore, the Air Force had jurisdiction over appellant at the time of this trial, and the findings and the sentence in this case should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant has the opportunity for rebuttal.
I'd like to start with Judge Olson's question, which essentially I think boils down to, on this critical issue of personal jurisdiction, shouldn't we hold the government's feet to the fire that they've done their job? At Joint Appendix 123, it's 199 of the record, this is the SJA testifying on cross-examination about what happened his office and ARPC regarding this issue. And the SJA is asked, and although the paperwork was provided, no one from this office was proactively following up with ARPC to make sure that Captain Nettles was coded. The SJA's answer on 123 of the Joint Appendix, It's respectfully not my office's job to make sure ARPC does theirs. Respectfully, sir, yes, it is. That's what Vander Bush says. Jurisdiction isn't some automatic thing that just keeps going and going. It's the government's responsibility to ensure that they have jurisdiction. And the courts would take a look at that and see how much the government cared about ensuring they had personal jurisdiction.
Do you agree that this would be a different case if Captain Nettles had been kept on active duty from the time that charges were preferred until the date?
Your Honor, I think the government would have a stronger argument. The argument I would make in response to that, though, is he's called to active duty. Let's say the orders say from today until February. His court-martial ended in February. So let's say that whole entire time they were able to guess, and they chose the date and said you're on active duty until, we'll say, March. What I would argue is, if everything else still happened as it was, even though the GCMA might have had that order with an effective date of March, the effective date would have still kicked in as 1 October because there wasn't magic that was putting Captain Nettles on active duty. It was a status from the IRR that allowed him to be recalled from there. If on 1 October he's no longer in the IRR, there's nowhere for him to be recalled from. So that's the argument I would put forward if that were the position, but I would concede the government would probably have a stronger argument regarding that. Regarding U.S. v. Harmon and this idea of command intent, I don't think the court meant what the government thinks it means. When the court was talking about command intent in Harmon, they were citing to the Marine Corps regulations, and they were citing to the face of the discharge document. They even say, the very front line is, from Harmon, the DD Form 214, in conjunction with the Navy Marine Corps regulation, indicated the command's intent. So the command intent is coming from the face of the document along with the Navy regulation. Well, the face of this document said 1 October it was effective. It cited a regulation that said it was issued under, which was AFI 36-3209. That regulation says at 2,400 hours it's effective. And then we have a federal statute backing that up that says it's a mandatory discharge. That's the command intent. The command intent actually favors appellant in this case. And one last point I would make, I don't think there's one case I came across where this court has ever said the government could go back and undo it after the fact. To conclude from Harmon, the discharge was not effective until 2359 hours. A valid legal hold was placed and his discharge was revoked before that time and date. And therefore, there was personal jurisdiction. If there's no further questions, I have nothing further, Your Honor, and I ran out of time.
There are no further questions. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and will stand in recess until 5 of the hour, 9:55. Thank you.